This is a Defocus Media production.
Hey everybody, I'm your four-eyed professor, Chris Levens, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Our roll call is for new and experienced ODs, optometry students, and even those just interested in this profession. We'll cover a number of topics together, and I'll help you see them through a professor's eyes. Please take your seats. School's in session.
And now a word from our sponsors. Did you know that 77% of eyeglass wearers wipe their lenses with t-shirts, tissues, or towels? Or that 1 in 3 people actually admit to accidentally dropping their glasses at least once a week? No one in the eye care industry needs to be told that this will lead to scratches on lenses and unhappy patients. So it's hardly surprising that 93% of wearers consider scratch resistance an important characteristic when choosing lenses. The latest Crizal lens innovation is here to help, and it's more durable than ever before. New Crizal Rock lenses are 3 times more scratch resistant than entry-level Crizal products and 2 times easier to clean than main competitors after extensive smudging. For more information about how you can bring this incredible new technology to your practice, go to EssilorPro.com/Crizal-Rock or contact your Essilor account executive for more details.
Hello again. Thanks for joining me today. And we are going to continue on the topic of optometric malpractice and really trying to tie a bow on this one. May hit back on it in the future for some very targeted messages. But I want to wrap up this segment with what I call the standard operating procedures to avoid trouble. So what final hints and what final things could we say that you can take with you in practice to hopefully do everything that you can to avoid what is a very big net that honestly none of us want to be caught in. So in no particular order, the first one is recording. And we had nearly an entire episode on that, given that it is a very difficult thing to do. So when you're recording, record what you did. And even if you make an assessment and it ends up being wrong in the end, that may not actually be a problem so long as it was logical and recorded appropriately. In fact, your decision making could have been correct based on the data you had at that time and the information available. Informed consent. Get permission to do anything to your patient and tell the patient what you find. A common complaint on the patient plaintiff side is that they weren't told. So tell the patient and write it down. Dilate the pupils. It's amazing that still, when you take all of the eye care malpractice cases together, 90% of those that involved an optometrist involved a misdiagnosis that was linked to lacking a dilated fundus examination. So either do it the same day or make a plan for it, and potentially you'll be left out of that boat. Reduced visual acuity. This one is a tricky one, and it's a dangerous landscape. This one's really common in pediatric cases. You know, we refer to the diagnosis of amblyopia as a diagnosis of exclusion, but it's hard to exclude everything. You know, one of the challenges we have in examining infants and children is reliability of visual acuity testing. Now, fortunately, we have methods that are actually quite simple, easily attainable, and quite reliable. So there are ways to do it. And the reason why this has a dangerous landscape is this is the case type that can result in a very large liability claim in the millions for reduced visual acuity and in some cases, if misdiagnosed, could be permanent. There's a case that I'm not going to spend time on describing, but you can do a Google search on it. It's Keir, K-E-I-R, versus the United States of America, given that it was a federal case. And this one involved a young girl who was diagnosed with bilateral amblyopia and ended up having bilateral retinoblastomas and ended up having bilateral enucleation. So both eyes removed. So we go from a child who can see and function to now a child with permanent blindness in both eyes. So if you remember to our very first discussion, and we talked about how, you know, when it comes to damages, the damages for the most part, with the exception of those that attempt to set an example, the whole idea of damages is to put someone financially in a position that they would have been in if the injury would never have occurred. Well, when it comes to a child who has a long life expectancy and who now has bilateral permanent blindness due to loss of her eyes, well, you can imagine how it gets to be in the millions, and that's an old case. So by today's standard, I can't even fathom how much that would be. When it comes to reduced VA, a dilated fundus exam always, and a consideration for a baseline visual field, or at least a very careful visual field assessment, and document it as such so that we don't confuse amblyopia as something that's quite different and could be quite more damaging. In the optical realm, prescribe polycarbonate lenses and tell your patient what they're for when eye protection is needed. CR39 plastic lenses do not equate to polycarbonate lenses. So for patients that have predominantly one functioning eye, whereas the other may not see very well, definite opportunity to go towards polycarbonate. Those who have a social history that may put their eyes at risk. So think of their occupation, certainly, but also think about their avocation and their hobbies. And do they do anything that actually puts their eyes at risk? Children, fantastic suggestion. It used to be many of us would veer away from polycarbonate because the optical quality of the material just wasn't as good. And so then it was a debate. Well, I could put you in a product that might keep you safer, but you may actually not see very as well. Well, now that's completely false. The optics of polycarbonate as a material have improved dramatically. So that's really no longer an issue. So think about the patients you're seeing in practice that really can be best suited for safety glass material and put it in them. The price difference is really absent. There's relatively no price difference and there's no difference in optical quality. All there is potential benefit for the safety aspects for your patients. Health exams on contact lens wearers. And this is the one I want to pause a little bit because I'm going to describe to you a case that is intriguing. There is actually the most discussed, widely discussed case in all of tort law for law students is actually a case involving the eyes and specifically ophthalmology. And I believe I alluded to this in a previous episode. So now I'm going to give you the nuts and bolts of this case. So this case, I believe, was in the 1970s. And it involved an ophthalmologist who was taking care of a young female and actually fitting her in contact lenses. And their doctor-patient relationship was over about a 9-year period. Well, at some point towards the end of this 9-year patient care, the doctor realized that this young female was actually experiencing some signs of glaucoma and had already experienced some permanent visual damage. Well, if you remember when we first started talking about malpractice in the very first episode about the four hoops that the patient plaintiff must jump through in order to get a case heard, one of those big ones was there has to be a standard of care out there, number one, and that which is determined, as we already talked about, through expert witness. And then number two, that the provider failed to meet that standard, okay? Well, again, this case is several decades ago. We didn't know as much as we did then, as we do today. And as it turned out, in those years, it was presumed that glaucoma was a disease of the elderly and really didn't affect young adults. And so health exams on contact lens wearers, specifically an intraocular pressure measurement, was just not done. IOP was not tested on every single patient like it is today. And so when the sides attempted through expert witness to define the standard of care, actually it was defined that an IOP measurement was not the standard of care. So the doctor who failed to test intraocular pressure at all during this nine-year doctor-patient relationship fitting here with contact lenses actually met the standard of care. So by the letter of the law in the United States, this case should have been dropped, thrown out, certainly never made, certainly not make it to trial. But sometimes in life, things surprise us and take a left turn. And this one actually did go to trial. And though expert after expert after expert was called to the stand to show and to claim and to agree that checking IOP on young adults is not the standard of care, the case wasn't thrown out. The judge stepped in and said, "I'm not an eye doctor, but that's a ridiculous standard of care. And all y'all need to start checking eye pressure on all the patients. If it could save vision in this one healthy young female, it potentially could save it in others, because IOP testing is not expensive. It's not complicated. It's not overly time consuming. It's not difficult to interpret, and everybody should do it." Well, wow. That's the reason why this case is the most widely discussed case in tort law, because it's shocking that a judge stepped in and basically overruled the whole design of the legal system in regards to malpractice. So I mention it to you because if in the 70s a judge can step in and overrule the standard of care and check an IOP on everyone when it wasn't the standard of care, you better believe it's expected today. So anytime a patient sits in the chair across from you, don't let them leave without doing some form of intraocular pressure. So if Goldman tonometry isn't going to go well, or they don't want it, or it's not going to suit them that day, we'll try, I don't know, something else. Eye care tonometry, the tonal pen, you know, as last resort, tactile, use your finger on both sides. Do something and record it as such, because this one's kind of a big deal. The whole category of disclosure, I could sum it up by saying this. Doctors have a fiduciary responsibility to their patients. And one of the main responsibilities is to alert them of their findings immediately and document them as such. So the proper disclosure of information to the patients is really our duty to them as their medical providers. Well, what about visual field testing? Don't define these as only for adults or only for those who may have, in your impression, the mental capability of testing and getting a good result. Don't assume that a patient is too old for a visual field test, and don't assume that a patient is too young for a visual field test. At a minimum, we should be doing confrontation visual fields on every one of our patients who sits across from us. The best way I can phrase it is this. On an automated visual field test, it is better to attempt the test and fail than to not test at all. Because testing, the art of testing, establishes the patient's capacity, whereas failing to do the test at all leads to second guessing and leads to your judgment about the patient's capacity, and we may be wrong, quite frankly. And honestly, this whole concept goes beyond. Anytime you have a patient who you assume may not be suited for a test, well, don't assume. It's better to try and fail than to not test at all. So another prime example would be, you saw on the chart that you attempted to dilate the patient's eyes last year and they didn't really dilate. Well, or they refused to let you get the drops in. Again, it's better to reattempt it and fail yet again than to assume incorrectly. In today's world of eye care, it's becoming more and more commonplace with each and every year for ophthalmology and optometry to co-manage patients. For that matter, we may be co-managing optometry to optometry. Well, when we're co-managing, particularly in post-surgical cases, there is almost always some form of co-management protocols, some documents and descriptors between the referral source and the referring doctor, the person who's providing the care at each point in the care of the patient, in which certain things should be done. So basically, have clear office procedures regarding the co-management protocols, make sure they're up to date, and most importantly, make sure everybody understands them, everybody knows where they're kept, and follow them. Very, very important. We touched on record keeping at the beginning. This is probably one of the most difficult things to fulfill on a daily basis. Just remember what I mentioned previously, that charting is the cornerstone of medical malpractice defense. And because it's so hard to do, it often is the easiest target for the plaintiff. The last thing I want to share with you on this topic are my final hints so that I can hope that this doesn't happen to you. Number one, never promise success. Don't do it. Honestly, we want to do it. It is very easy to say, oh, Miss Jones, you know what? This is the year where your cataracts are ready to come out. But don't worry. This is a very simple procedure. Thousands of people have it done every single year. It's been around for a very long time. It's very safe. And you're going to see better. You are going to love your vision when you get this done. Okay, that sounds an awful like promising success. And if it just so happens that this is the patient in the one of the thousands that something goes awry, well, it doesn't matter to that patient how low the odds were. To them, it happened to them. And now they have to deal with it. And if you promise success, they then may look to you because that's a fraudulent claim. Number two, if possible, and it's not always possible, but when it's possible, avoid arguments over money. When we take all lawsuits together and put them in a big bucket, one of the most common reasons to have anyone initiate a lawsuit is an argument over money. So I'm not saying you shouldn't collect what you're due. What I'm saying is be cognizant of how the other person's reacting and is it worthwhile to jump in that argument or not. Number three, record keeping yet again. Keep complete, legible, contemporary records. They can only protect you. And the last, number four hint is be friendly. Be friendly. Have your patients like you. As it turns out, when patients like you, they're far less likely to sue you. There's no guarantees there, but it certainly could not hurt. So thanks again for joining me on this particular topic. We are going to change gears and change course in future ones, but we may touch back on this one every so often. But it's my pleasure to do anything that I can to protect you in this area of patient care that is actually quite tricky.
Class is ended for today, and we have no exams or grades approaching. Please email me at foureyedprofessor@gmail.com if there are topics that you would like to hear and see through a professor's eyes.